I'm Clint Emerson, and welcome to Season 2 of Can You Survive This Podcast, where the interview is just as dangerous as the scenarios I put my guests through. From hostage situations to natural disasters, carjackings, active shooters, and more, if you're looking for the skills necessary to survive these situations, then this is the show for you. Hey, what's up, everyone? This is Clint, and thank you for listening to another episode of Can You Survive This Podcast? We are doing a compilation of the greatest hits, if you will, of the past. And we thought, hey, why not give you a taste of the best interviews you may have missed, the best survival stories and tips you may not have paid attention to last time? So hold on and get ready for Can You Survive This Podcast's greatest hits. Enjoy. The differences between the SBS and the SAS, and we know that the SAS is kind of the more popular one that we've heard about for decades. You guys, or they were the, I mean, heck, I look up to them, looked up to them throughout my career. You always hear things about, you know, the Brits, you guys have been doing it longer when it came to counterterrorism. You had all the experience for a very long time. But what are the really the big differences between the SAS and the SBS?
Do you know what? The only difference between the two, we do exactly the same selection process. So there's only one tier one sort of organization, and that's the SBS, Special Boat Service, and the SAS. The SBS is the Navy Special Forces.
Yeah.
And the SAS is the Army Special Forces. So exactly the same selection process, and that at the end, you can sort of pick and choose where you want to go. You know, I was an ex-Royal Marine, so we stay loyal to the Navy. So I stay loyal to the Navy and went SBS. And normally the Army, if you're ex-infantry or parachute regiment or whatever it may be, you stay loyal to the Army and you go to the SAS. But they're almost exactly the same. But we lead with maritime counterterrorism, and the SAS lead when it comes to land options. But in a couple of years, Clint, I think that everything will amalgamate into one fighting unit. You know, this whole tier one will just amalgamate into one fighting unit, because we do exactly the same selection process. And we, as the SBS, we led out in Afghanistan. Now, there's not much water in Afghanistan, but that was our territory for 15 years. And for the SAS, it was Iraq. So now, you know, we come from the air, we come from land, we come from water. You know, I would say that the Special Boat Service has the slight advantage of being versatile. You know, we spend a lot of time on the water. You add water to anything, as you know, Clint, it can become a complete cluster fuck, right? It can really, really mess things up. And if you can operate on water and with water around you, underwater, on top of it, then you know you can pretty much operate anywhere in the world. That's what I believe. So we have that advantage of just, you know, that maritime training, and also, you know, when it comes to land stuff and you're nice and dry, you always sort of thank your lucky stars that you're not, you know, wet, cold, and miserable before you start a task.
Yeah, no doubt about that. And that's a great explanation. So, you know, for American listeners, really, the SBS is equivalent to SEAL Team 6, and the SAS is equivalent to, like, Delta Force. And
absolutely. And then
the reality is we, the United States military, have mirrored a lot of our organizational structure, terminology, I mean, you name it, tactics, based on you guys. And, you know, it's a cool history. You know, it was amazing to me the other day to see it in social media. You know, we just celebrated, I think it was, the Navy's birthday several months ago, and it was, you know, 200 and whatever years old. And then I saw, the Royal Marines' birthday, and it's 100 plus years older than our Navy, you know, 300 and something years old. And, you know, it's very telling that, you know, the power and the longevity of the Brits and you guys being around for so long. It's pretty cool.
But we work closely with, we, you know, with Team Six, with Dev Group. We've adapted a lot of drills especially in that Afghanistan era. We've worked very closely with Dev Group, and we've adapted a lot of drills, you know, from the way we enter buildings, the way we fight from the door now, the way we fight from windows, the way we roll into certain tasks, vehicle interdictions, you know, Afghanistan, you know, that sort of came into place. And the drills and skills that we've adapted has been jointly with Team Six, you know, so we work ever so closely together, and we've adapted this sort of new age modern warfare through American, through the Americans yourselves and through the Brits. So even though we might be older in our organization, we work very, very closely together, and we've come up with a highly effective operational close quarter combat drills and skills intertwined with Dev Group and Team Six. So, you know, we can't take all the glory, but right now it is 50-50, and you know, we do work closely together and adapt everything that we do to fit a modern day battlefield.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I've had the opportunity to work with all you guys, and it's always professional and a fun experience with that. Just like you do, I get lots of questions about BUDS, right? Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL training. What's the hardest part? What's this? What's that? So for our listeners, selection for you guys, what are like the highlight? You know, we have Hell Week and we have Pull Comp, and then we go out to San Clemente Island where people can't hear you scream, and that's where you get even further, you know, torture of different sorts. But what are the highlights of selection that, you know, most people like fear, or that anticipation of death is worse than death itself type moment? What was it for you, or what is the more popular one, popular parts of selection?
It's broke down into stages. So the first 4 weeks of selection is in the Brecon Beacons. And it's called the hill phase, where you carry extreme weight on your back over extreme distance, and you're timed along the way, and you have to meet certain criteria, certain time restrictions. And in the first 4 weeks, 70% of the course is gone. In those first 4 weeks, because you're up, you know, 4:30 in the morning, you're sat on your Bergen in the Brecon Beacons, it's pissing it down. You've got the big four tunnel lights that are shined upon you. The chief instructor comes out, all you can see is his shadow. And he's telling you, because you're just a number, he's telling you what number to get onto what wagon. And he gives you the opportunity every morning to VW, because you don't know what march is ahead of you. You don't know how long you're going to be out on the ground for. And the first 4 weeks is just gets rid of the dead wood. Because a lot of people, they go on selection just for the kudos. You know, they get on selection and they come back, go back to their unit, and I've been on selection. And it sort of does boost their career a little bit. But the first 4 weeks is just all, you know, it's just humping and you know, getting across the Brecon Beacons, which is, you know, disgusting. You get four seasons in one. It's horrendous the first 4 weeks. But when you get past the first 4 weeks, that's when the course starts. So you've lost 70% of the course. 202 people started my course. I think 34 of us got to the next stage, which is the jungle phase. So you do jungle training, and it's 6 weeks long. So you do 2 weeks of sort of beat up jungle training. It's you know, horrendous. And then you go and fly out to Brunei for 4 weeks, and you conduct live exercise, live rounds, break contact drills, evacuation drills, camp attacks, you name it, all live ammunition. And that's more to see how you operate under extreme sort of pressure and fatigue with live ammunition, how safe you are. Because we both know the moment you get one tick for one safety element, you're off the course. Now, when you're in the jungle for four whole weeks and you're being assessed with live ammunition, break contact drills any time of the day, because all you're doing is patrolling. And then at the end of that phase, you do 10 days of a proper final ex. Again, you lose another half of the course, just mainly due to self-induced pressure, where they've made a mistake. It might not be a safety mistake, but they've made a mistake, and you know, the DS don't tell you anything. So you plant that seed of doubt yourself, and you go, right, you know, I'm not going to pass this phase, so there's no point in carrying on. And a lot of people VW in the trees in the jungle. But again, you make one safety mistake, you're off. So that's the second phase. That's all about soldiering. And then you've got the escape and evasion, which is the third phase, which again is, you know, in the highlands of Scotland, no one can hear you scream. No one can hear you talk. You're on the run for a whole week Before you get captured, you know, you get to a final RV, double agent, et cetera, and then you go through a three-day interrogation process. And then once you, if you pass that, then that's the bulk of selection done. That takes about 4 months. And then you go on to continuation training, which again is another 2 months before you actually get badged. And that's all your CQB. That's your shotgun drills, you know, taking off doors, abseiling into buildings. You're in the killing house 24/7. Again, one safety mistake on that, you're gone as well. Mm-hmm. So 202 people started my course, and on badging day, 8 of us passed. So it's very much, it's full on for 6 months. There's no rest period. There's no, you know, that stress of just staying in that zone, as you will know, for 6 months is tiring. But you get to the 4 month period, and if you pass the escape and evasion, you can take a breath. You can go, right, listen, all I need to do now is really, you know, because it's a new learning phase. You need to stay on the learning curve, really take on board what's been taught every single day, and do not make any safety errors.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Safety and performance, safety is always primary. And mm-hmm. Just for a language barrier, a Bergen is a rucksack, right? What we call that's a rucksack, right? Here. Mm-hmm. Pissing is when it's raining. And then VW is voluntary withdrawal. What else did you say that we need to do?
You
that?
Know what? The voluntary the, withdrawal is,
you know, translation.
Like when you guys ring the bell. You know when you ring the bell?
Ding, ding, ding.
And they put their helmets down. It's right.
Yeah, we call it, what they used to, I think it's changed name. I mean, it's like never ring the bell. It's quitting. But the official term is drop on request, D-O-R. You D-O-R, drop on request. You guys call it VW, which is voluntary withdrawal. Yeah. Good stuff.
Because at the end of the day, Clint, we're all volunteers. You know, they don't really want you to pass their course. You know, you have to really, really prove yourself to them. And, you know, we've done, you know, by this stage, before we even get on selection, you know, the average soldier would have done 6 to 10 years. You know, there'd be an elite infantryman, there'd be a sniper, there'd be a recce troop operator. And even then, you know, we go on the course, and, you know, it's a 90%, 95% failure rate of all the elite soldiers that are trying for selection. So it's, you know, it is really the attention to detail, as we mentioned before, staying sharp, even when you're absolutely on the bones of your ass and you're trying to crawl up a ridge line, you know, in the jungle, and you're just slipping down it because it's just getting tangled up everywhere. It's just making sure that you keep that finger on that safety catch so it doesn't clip off. Or, yeah, you know, you don't ND, do a negligent discharge. It's so many little things that you just need to stay switched on to when you're absolutely drained. And I suppose it's super important because, you know, you see it happening quite more than we'd like to think. You know, running off an aircraft and boom, someone catching up in the ass or in the leg off of their own dude. You're like, that's unacceptable, you know?
Mm-hmm. No doubt about it. I agree with you 100%. H&K or Glock?
Glock.
Yeah. I know you guys now getting into the British Special Forces, the current weapon of choice is what? H&Ks and Glocks? Or what are y'all guys rolling with these days?
So the UK, so unlike the US military, where you all pretty much have similar weapon systems, whether you're in the Marines or the Rangers, the Green Berets, and all the way through to Tier 1. Ours is separate. So the rest of it, I call it the Green Army. The Green Army have the SA-80, A2, which is HK components.
Yeah.
And then when we go Special Forces, we use the C8 DeMarco, and we have the Sig Sauer and the Glock as a secondary weapon. And I think the reason we do that is so, should we be captured, we look like Americans, and it's all deniability.
Yeah, because you're C8.
Blame the Americans.
Your C8's is like a 416, right? Or our M4s or our carbines. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a Canadian version of the M4. Yeah.
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 A lesser weapon.
A lesser, yeah.
H&K or Sig Sauer? You went with H&K, which I know is an old favorite of the British Special Operations guys.
Yeah, I went for the Heckler & Koch because I was a big fan of the Heckler & Koch 417, yeah. The assault rifle, the 7.62 version.
It's a badass, very, yeah.
And it was, it's especially for Afghanistan, it wasn't too long. You know, you could still have it. It had a, you know, nice impactful 7.62, obviously, but it was small enough to operate through, you know, through compounds, through buildings. You know how small the cubby holes are, and it still had that impact of, you know, you knew that once that hit you, you know, you weren't getting back up.
Yeah, I wish we kind of went with the 416, you know, mm-hmm. which is the 5.56 version, but that 7.62 version, that's like, you know, small gun, big round. I love it, man. That's cool.
Vertex or Omega? You picked Omega. I think I know why.
I picked Omega for the same reason I picked Aston Martin, really, because, you know, that was really, that goes back to the old days. That was the first service watch for the SBS that I can remember in my time anyway. And also the fact I thought, what have I got in my watch collection? You know, and that was, I haven't got a Vertex. Mm-hmm. I've got a James Bond Omega. So I'm like cruising down the James Bond theme, aren't I?
Yeah, you are. That's all right. We all want to be James Bond.
I am actually the original 00.
You are, Allerton, I know. So, I saw it on Instagram. You have it up in your thing, 00. And I'm like, yeah, he's a fucking former 00 guy.
That's it, mate.
Assassin. yeah, I think, one of my first watches was an Omega Seamaster as well, but hanging out with you guys, I learned that you guys actually hand out is it personalized or custom Omegas to your operators, or what's the story behind that?
Yeah, I mean, you can actually buy them. They don't hand them out, but you know, if you want to, it used to be Omega. They've now signed a deal with, I think I've got a more recent one, which is a Bremont, which is a British, a newer British brand. But yeah, if you want to buy it, you can buy one of those watches at a superb discount. They don't just hand them out. So,
right. It's for SBS guys only, correct?
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Correct.
And then what do SAS guys, what's their, is it the same?
I think they have a Swatch.
I used to collect those.
I did till I was about 10.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, I think Hereford have gone with either Rolex or Breitling.
Yeah. Sure. I can see Breitling being, because it's kind of that whole aviation up in the air thing.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. You're listening to Can You Survive This Podcast? Thanks for tuning in. Please make sure to subscribe, rate, and share on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite shows. Now, this one gets into more, you know, the British SAS SBS history. So, canoe or jet boat?
Ooh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Canoe.
Yeah, I was hoping you were going to say that, because that is definitely a delineating difference. You have U.S. Navy SEALs, and then you have the British SBS, which is the Special Boat Service, which you are obviously part of. And what I find interesting is we don't, as SEALs, we don't get into canoes or kayaks or any of that as a form of infiltration. We kind of go from diving straight to our jet boats. You guys, though, have this awesome tradition and history where the canoe is a part of your selection and everything, right?
Yeah, well, there was a famous operation back in the Second World War called Operation Frampton, where 10 swimmer canoeists from the SBS inserted into France and destroyed a lot of the shipping in the Bordeaux River. You know, of the 10, two didn't successfully get off the submarine. So, two survived in the end, and they escaped and evaded, stole a bike, got over the Pyrenees and cycled all the way down to Gibraltar. You know, it's a famous operation.
That's so cool.
Where they came in and just put limpet mines on these vessels. You know, there's rumors that that one operation could shorten the war by 6 months. But so it's a famous thing. There's a movie called The Cockle Shell Hero. So they inserted on these, they're called Klepper canoes, with wooden frames and these canvas coverings. They're very low profile. And obviously, you know, going up rivers, inserting in those days was covert. We do it on our Special Forces boat course. You know, we do a week of kleppering. The great thing about the klepper is you can portage it. You can collapse it down and put it into two guys' bergens. You know, it's a two-man canoe, you know, then move across the land and then open up again. It's difficult. It's hard. And we do it in the boat course just so we know that it is an option if we need it. To do that, there was an operation in the last decade I can't really talk about, where they actually used a Klepper canoe. So what that did is then kept it in service for like another 30 years. So this thing should have been obsolete back in the Second World War. But in the current climate, you know, there's still options that we can use it.
Yeah, I think it's super cool, man. You guys have quite the history, unlike us. We're still the new guys on the block, but man, so fucking cool. American military is not as educated on foreign service medals and accomplishments as most of the world is on ours, right? Everyone in the world has heard of a Silver Star, a Bronze Star. The American awards are kind of global, whereas, you know, other countries' awards, we're not as in tune to them. But you've received the King's Badge. Now, can you?
Yeah.
What is that? What is that equivalent to? And, you know, how did you get that?
So during Royal Marine training, it's a 9-month process. I know it's the longest infantry training in the world. That's why we've got a very good reputation, because before we even get to a unit, you know, we've done all the live firing, we've done multiple exercises. And again, you know, it's a big failure rate in the Royal Marines. It's an extremely hard 9 months, and you can join straight off Sibley Street. It's like joining, you know, the Navy SEALs, apart from obviously minus Dev Group. But it's like, you know, you're going straight into the fold. You know, there's no messing around. You either you've got to stay with it or not. And it dates back to a prince that done the commando course and who absolutely nailed it. And there's set criteria and points that you have to get up to that standard. So within each troop, obviously everything that you do is a point system. So, you know, you have to stay on the ball, you have to stay up there. And if you get over what the prince got, I think years and years ago, he was part of the royal family. And if you get over that point system, then you're awarded the King's Badge. And what it does, it gives you a year's seniority when you get to your unit. It's a badge of honor that you wear throughout all your uniform, throughout your whole career. But not every troop gets it. So a lot of troops don't get the King's Badge. So people just don't reach that point system, or people can't get up to that to that level. So it's once you get there, you don't know if anyone's got the King's Badge. And then I got pulled aside one day and told that, you know, I excelled the point system, and I received the King's Badge. So it's it's not a combat badge. It's more of a, you know, you've excelled as a Royal Marine commando. But there's a lot of emphasis on you. You know, when you get to a unit, I more or less got promoted straight away. Within 6 months, you know, I got promoted to Lance Corporal, and, you know, you can put a lot of noses out of joint. So I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, but no, it's definitely something that that I'm proud of. You know, I'm in the drill shed, my name's up on the board with all of these fantastic people or operators that have passed the Royal Marine Commando training course. It's a big thing for Royal Marine. But then you venture into the Special Forces world, and that all of that disappears, right?
Yeah. Then all of a sudden you're zero.
Yeah, exactly.
You're just a new guy. Hey, new guy.
Yeah, exactly.
All the shit you did before you came here, guess what? Doesn't mean dick.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the most dangerous situation you feel like you've ever been in?
Military or just in general?
Yeah, just in general. Yeah. Mainly where you've had a lot of lessons learned come out of it, where you're like, whoa, man, wish I would have done this or this, you know?
Yeah, there's one actually, and it's in the prologue and epilogue of my book. It's, you know, so when I was in Afghanistan, we used to work with the, you know, Secret Service, and we used to go pick up Taliban agents. So I used to dress up as a local Taliban and drive into Kandahar and go pick up these agents. So we would do this day in, day out. There's no point in us planning a route, because every day, you know, when you go into the city, there'd be roadblocks, there'd be situations. So we knew where we were going, and we just had to get there. And what would happen is I'd normally lead vehicle, me and one of the Afghan SF guys would be in the front of me. You know, we would drive by the target, second vehicle would pick up the target, third would make sure we got no follow-up. You know, those are our normal SOP without giving too much away. So We do this day in, day out. There's one day we went into town. The road that we initially wanted to take was blocked. So I then got diverted to right, and it was just bumper to bumper traffic. And I just remember people, it was a very narrow market street. There's people walking down the sides of the vehicles, and the people were tapping on the window and talking to me. And I would always direct them to Hekmat, and he would do the talking. But there was a lot of attention. I don't like anything in my eyes. So I had a nice big black beard, no tan skin, turban, looked the part, but a big beaming blue eyes. So initially I thought, I've been compromised.
Yeah.
And so, I said to the heck man, I think we've been compromised. It came up over the net. So it just goes radio silent. So in my head, I'm thinking, the worst case scenario, as you do, orange boiler suit, CNN tonight, 9 o'clock news, this guy. So in my head, I'm thinking about the IA drill, the immediate action drill, what I need to do. Obviously, I can't divulge that on this show. So, I'm thinking about that. And the initial thing is to grab the weapon under my seat, which is a MP5 Kurtz. So it's got no barrel. And you just empty the magazine 30 rounds into the windscreen. Gives yourself time to grab your weapon and then get on your flip-flops and start heading back to camp, which was about 18 miles as the crow flies from this point. So here's me in my head, going over this situation, planning it out. And just as I was about, during this whole situation, the vehicles are slowly edging forward. So HQ said, on your call, you make the decision. So, okay, as I was just about to grab it, the second vehicle come by around the corner, and my friend Ads, he came up over the net, and he's like, stop. So straight away you just drop everything, your whole body just freezes, yeah. Drop the weapon, and he says your turban's caught in the door. So for me it was like a real life lesson how I misread a situation, but I knew I shouldn't have been there. My senses were so heightened, thinking the worst case scenario, when in fact people have been genuinely nice and trying to help me. So that's the real life lesson for me. And in the fact, there wasn't any explosions. There wasn't any shooting. It was just, and I always say it when I do lectures on security and things like that, don't run into a situation. Just step back, have a look. And that's what I didn't do. I was so immersed in it. And I knew that I shouldn't be there. So my senses were heightened. So I wasn't making the right decisions.
I love that story because it supports what I put in the first little book I ever did was Escape the Wolf. And it's an awareness book. And in there, I would talk about anytime you arrive into a new area, new country, you're going to be oversensitized. Your brain and everything is going to be trying to pay attention to everything because everything in front of you is new. And you're going to think that everything is after you, right? You're going to see ghosts. You're going to see goblins. You're going to see everything that you think you can see. In that environment, when the reality is it's nothing, it's just a new culture, a new place. So you got to almost step back from all of that temporary paranoia, and just kind of drive forward, but keep your wits about you at the same time. But man, that's a fucking great example of what I've talked about in there. For those of you listening, mostly my US folks, SAS is a show, and this show is incredible. It emulates lightly the SAS SBS selection process. And for those of you catching up, SAS SBS is, the tier one forces in England. And those guys go through a similar selection as any of us Navy SEALs or any other special operation guys here in the United States. And the show does this great job, really putting the recruits through 14 days of kind of the sort of type of atmosphere that any regular Joe that signs up for the military and wants to be special, they have to go through this selection process. And so the UK one, correct me, Ollie, if I'm incorrect, was really you guys took on the average Joe, whereas in Australia, it's celebrities, right?
Yeah, we did. I mean, the UK one was first targeted at, first of all, it was just men. So, it was true authenticity of the selection process in the UK. So, which at that time was only open to men. And then we sort of evolved into opening that up to both genders. And then we sort of evolved into the celebrity version of the show. Obviously, SAS Australia, we have done a non-celebrity version, but the main sort of primary show is really about celebrities. And I do have to say that I love the celebrity one more than I do the non-celebrity. And the reason for that is because it absolutely shows and typifies the process and how it works on Special Forces selection. And that is, for the viewer looking in, all these celebrities, we have a perception. Everyone has a perception of who this person is. The media creates a perception of that person. So we then build how we perceive this each individual celebrity. But then it shows how the process absolutely works, because all the way through that process, it delivers a totally different person at the back end.
Yeah, it does.
And that is absolutely what happens on selection.
Right.
You know, people get such an internal view of who they really are. The ego's wiped out the way. You know, they're put into a sort of theater where they feel vulnerable. So their thoughts, feelings, actions, and reactions become organic and raw. They don't get to design the perfect outcome, which, especially as a celebrity, they're always designing a perfect outcome to make them look good. Mm-hmm. So it shows that process working, and I can really relate to that, and I'm sure you can, Clint. On selection, you are a different person by the time you come out the back end.
No doubt about it. I think you just hit like all those important features of a selection. Mm-hmm. And no doubt, like those recruits, those celebrities, you nailed it. They're used to a scripted life. And when they show up to SAS, it is completely unscripted. There is, it's the four of us and the, 20 or 17 or whatever the number is of them. We're all living together. It's real. You don't even really see cameramen or audio folks. No one's saying, cut, repeat that line, please. You know, it is just raw and real. And that was the big surprise for me. You know, within 24 hours, I was like, holy shit, it's really the four of us actually running all this crap. That was the impressive and actually the coolest part of the deal was knowing that and being a part of it. And it was just, and I mean, fuck, man, we had so much fun just getting through each of those days. Those long days didn't even seem long at all. Hanging out with you and Ant and Dean. I mean, it was just an awesome experience. Daniel Craig, Sean Connery, of course, putting both James Bonds head to head.
I'd say Sean Connery because I grew up watching, watching that film, the Bond series religiously. And I think that was over my most influential years. And he's left us now, but God bless him. I do love Daniel Craig. I think he's absolutely brilliant. I've got to do it out of respect for the man, Sean Connery.
Same for me. James Bond overall is a big influence, I think, for any guy in our age group, or heck, even the new guys that wanted to go into special operations. I mean, there's always that spec ops flair to any James Bond movie, especially the Daniel Craig ones. I mean, that is they added that little bit of John Wick to James Bond and turned him into this just lethal motherfucker, which Sean Connery was more etiquette protocol gentlemanly, right?
And yeah,
100% womanizer.
Chivalry. There's a lot more chivalry.
There
Sean's David.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
did Sean Connery ever get a sir in front of his name? Did he ever get a knight?
I think he certainly should have.
Yeah. Huh.
Well, they gave Tony Blair one, so they should bloody give him one. No one wanted that to happen.
That's pretty funny. We did McLaren versus Aston Martin. You picked the Aston Martin.
Yeah, Aston Martin is, I'm not into supercars, to be honest, because I always have to have a practical reason for everything and a purpose. Mm-hmm. All of my cars, all the cars I've got, have got a functional reason why I've got that car. So for me to have a sports car is like, I just, is it for ego? Is that why people get them? So for me, it's like, but if I had any car, you know, just that Aston Martin would do it for me. You know, I was lucky enough to get one lent to me by Aston Martin for my wedding. And it was incredible. And I've driven a McLaren as well, but which is an amazing bit of kit. Mm-hmm. But for me, it's that good old British, you know.
Yeah.
It's that heritage, isn't it? You know, it's like the old James Bond heritage. So it's more authentic, I believe.
Yeah, it does. It matches you with, you know, with the guns and the headlights and all.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm with you. I think Aston Martins are like, you know, they've got this, they've got all the luxury and sport crushed into this badass design. I mean, you can't beat the lines of an Aston Martin. Those lines are beautiful, right?
Yeah.
Now, okay, this is going to be your biggest challenge, is your hypothetical survival scenario that we built just for you, okay?
Wow.
Now, I'm going to tell you ahead of time. There's right answers and wrong answers, but the only one that matters is our answer, okay? So you can rationalize all fucking day long, and it doesn't matter, Dean, okay? You're either going to be right or wrong according to the story maker, all right? So are you ready?
Yes, please.
Okay, here we go. We will be right back after the break. All right, so you're in a foreign country on a job for a very private, high net worth client. Okay. The city is unnamed, but it's densely populated and urban. A whole lot of new wealth, but massive poverty. Okay. Sound familiar?
Yes.
There are dense clusters of large new buildings and tenants all crammed into a very, you know, confined area. You've been flown into the city one day early before your actual security gig. Okay. You're at a hotel. It's not very nice. Okay. But it's the night before your job. You're winding down, kind of taking a moment before you start your gig the next day. And by the way, how do you wind down? You get into hotel. Do you have any, like, you know, do you have a routine when you get into hotel rooms or?
I don't really. My wind down is when the job is over.
Yeah.
And I'm out of country. That's my wind down. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. It's got to stay alert the whole time. So it's the night before the job starts. Okay. Now you're kind of relaxing. And, you know, maybe prepping is probably the better thing we all do, is you're prepping for your next day and you hear banging at your door. Okay. And someone shouts, "This is the police. You're under arrest for robbing those banks. Open the door." Okay. So first question. All right. And now if you were sitting here in person, but because you came to Dallas and didn't tell me, and now you're in LA and now we're doing the show, which is bad on you to come to Dallas. On the screen here, we've got your first question. So do you keep the door closed and sneak out the window, or B, request that they hold their credentials up at the peephole?
The B, because I don't want to inflate the situation. But what I always do, and I always have with me when I'm on trips, is a door wedge, a 99-cent door wedge, because you don't know who has access to these hotel cards.
Yeah.
So I always stick that behind the door.
Hell
just in case they did. Yeah, just in case they did have their own swipe entrance. But I don't want to inflate. I know that I haven't robbed anyone, so I don't want to sort of inflame the situation.
Right. You don't want to fire them up, and I do the same. It's I think that's a little trick in the security world that us security guys know, is I carry four of the little wooden wedges that come in the it's a Slim Jim kit. I don't know if you've seen those. To jimmy the door open, you have these long reach tools. And they have the perfect, like, wooden wedges that you can get through security. You don't have to worry because it's not metal and all that. And then, you know, you can do one or two at the top, two into this on the lock side, and one at the bottom. And, you know, it's going to keep people out for sure. That's a great point, man. And you are correct, B, right? Since you haven't done anything wrong, there's no need to run and be arrested or fleeing. I mean, that's just going to make you look guilty. They're two officers. They're in proper uniform. They flash their credentials, so everything looks legit at this point. So good job. All right, so next, do you tell them they've made a mistake and to go away, or B, you know, crack the door, give in a little bit. You've got the lock on the door, but you can crack it just a little bit and confirm everything.
Yeah, I'd go B. I think I'd wait to see what their initial reaction was from when we ask them for the credentials, and if they've shown me, then yeah, I'll crack the door again. It's trying to not inflame that situation, but obviously conscious that, you know, you need to react if need be.
Right. And I think you follow some of the same principles when you were in the military. There's a big difference. Like in the military, for me, in a lot of these countries I was operating in, I didn't pull over for police. I didn't open fucking doors for police. Police were basically equivalent to bad guys. But as a civilian, you got to kind of treat things a whole lot different because you don't have, you don't have the 800-pound gorilla of the United States military, you know, backing you up one border away. You know what I mean?
True.
Yeah. So, cracking the door and kind of, it's kind of a give, right? It's kind of like giving them a little bit of something to keep them satisfied. Yeah.
True.
So B, yes, correct. All right. So next one, the police ask if they can come in and ask you some questions. So A, let them in, or B, tell them to come back with a warrant and shut the door. You're in someone else's country, so it's a tough one.
If there was a third option, I'd ask if we could go into the public lobby and just chat there.
It's a great point.
Again, they're not going to come back with a warrant. I've worked in some of these places, I'd go with A.
Let them in. And yes, A is correct. And I'm with you because you and I both know the legal systems really only work in 1, 2, maybe 3 countries on this fucking planet. It's corrupt. I mean, it's corrupt. It's semi-permissive if you're lucky. And the law enforcement certainly... bribery and taking cash and all that is like a primary form of income for these folks, right?
True. I sort of learned as well, especially like going around, because I worked all over Africa and the Middle East, is that the laws that we have in UK and America are for UK and America. You can't enforce them in another country.
Yeah.
So people used to ask me questions about buying weapons on the black market. It's legal. I've done nothing illegal there. You know, it's all legal in that country.
If I
did it in the UK, it'd be totally illegal.
Yeah.
So, you need to understand. And as you touched on, before you go to these countries, you understand their cultures, their laws and things like that. So you don't get tripped up as well. And you understand that is normal. Is it normal in the US and isn't normal in the UK, but it is normal in wherever we are.
Right. In those countries, you know, they don't call them black markets. They're called open air markets. You walk up and you buy whatever the fuck you want.
Or the hotel manager.
It's not until you leave the country, you go, oh, yeah, those, I guess, were considered black markets. But they're just open air markets. They're like a souk. A souk of weapons. I'm with you, man. That's good stuff. So you let them in. All right. They tell you that they need your passport. Okay. This is where, you know, this is the part that bugs me even in real life. You know, anybody who needs my passport. So they say, hey, we need your passport and you got to come with us. And so do you A, refuse and request to call your embassy, or B, cooperate with the police and go ahead and, you know, give them your passport?
So what I always do, and I do it when I do my travel security to people, before I go anywhere, I take photocopies of my passport, I take photocopies of my yellow fever cards and things like that. So when you have, when people ask you, especially some of these hotels you go to around the world, oh, we need to take your passport to get it scanned. Well, here, I've already got a photocopy, so that should do the job. So you never lose sight of your passport. So that was what I would do in this situation.
Yeah.
I keep my passport on me, but I would give them my photocopy, because then you've actually agreed to what they've asked.
Yep.
You've given them what they need and without upsetting them. So I always have photocopies for those scenarios.
Yeah. Okay. I like it. And that's all great points. And I think it's stuff that even if you go to the statedepartment.gov here in the United States, you go there, it's going to tell you all these things. It really does. It's a great source. You know, another great source of information is if you're going to, let's say, whatever that country is, go to that country's embassy websites. Every single one of them have embassy websites now. We tend to go, oh, I'm just going to look at American stuff, even though I'm traveling to Egypt. It's like, no, go to the Egyptian consulate website, and they will tell you exactly what the do's and don'ts, which is it's a much better source of information. So, that's good stuff. You feel everything start to shake, okay? Do you A, get up and rush out of the home, or B, stay in the house? Now, there's a lot of protocols that come with earthquakes that you may or may not know about, but you're going to A, get up and run outside, or are you B, going to stay inside?
Depends how violent the shake is. I would say that the first initial shake, I'd probably stay put. So, I'd stay put, assess it, and then go from there.
There you go. Look at you. So, yes, you want to stay in the house. There's a lot of common misconceptions when dealing with the earthquakes and the protocol that come with it. But rushing outside, especially at night, you don't know what you're running into. And the structure you're inside of is going to protect you more than probably whatever's falling outside. You don't want to put yourself at risk, especially at night. So good job. Yes, B, stay in the house. All right, next. Do you A, lay down next to a sturdy piece of furniture, like a big couch or a table, or B, go stand in a door frame? It's a tough one.
I would say A, because if anything was to fall, then that sturdy bit of furniture would hopefully protect you from any.
Good job. Yes. A. Another misconception, because you'll hear about it here in the States, is go stand in a door frame. But unfortunately, door frames are not like reinforced. They're just a door frame. And there's nothing that's really going to protect you. But a couch laying horizontally up against it will hopefully break the fall of other debris, because the number one killer in an earthquake is falling debris. So you want to basically take cover, if you will. All right. So the initial shake has stopped. All right. So now do you A, stay put and assess, take a moment and kind of look, listen, and feel, right? Or B, get up and rush out of the house?
A.
A, you are. Yes. You are correct, sir. The leading cause of death, obviously, is the falling debris. You want to stay. You want to assess. You want to take a moment and make sure you've got your wits about you and you're looking around at what the condition of what's around you, So awareness is key. You're about to exit the home when there's another aftershock, right? They have these post-earthquake tremors that you definitely have to be on high alert for. But this time you tumble, you fall over, and some debris and rubble kind of falls down on top of you. All right. So you're covered in this rubble. All right. Do you A, use all your strength and push the rubble and debris off to escape, or B, slowly crawl and make your way towards whatever light that is, that you can actually see and slowly remove debris?
I would say it would be B.
Yes.
Slowly.
Yeah.
Just take it slow. You don't want to be rushing up. You might be rushing into more mayhem.
That's right. The slow movement, especially with fallen debris, is really important when you test. If you have to move something and you kind of grab it, let's say it's a boulder, let's say it's a pipe, whatever it is, and you grab it and you realize there's weight on it, then you don't want to touch it any longer. Right? You don't want to muscle that, because you could pull that piece of furniture, that pipe, that rock, and all of a sudden more stuff. It could be load bearing. You don't want to be messing around with load bearing stuff. So you want to touch it. If it's loose, move it. If it's stuck, leave it alone and then create a pathway out. And this applies not just to earthquakes. I mean, this is, you find yourself in terrorist events where explosives are used and the building has fallen, anytime anything has fallen, you want to be cautious on how you move things, because you could just make it worse. So strong winds make it difficult to control the vehicle. Visibility is low. And visibility basically gets to whiteout condition. Do you A, safely pull over the car on the shoulder of the road, or B, pull the car onto a median?
Until what?
A median, like a sidewalk, or onto an elevated side of the road. Put it on the shoulder, which is level with the road, or do you, bump over and get on top of something else?
I'd go for B.
B? Let's see what this thing says. A, pull over on the shoulder. Let's see why. Pull over as in make your way to a hotel or a gas station. pulling into a median is dangerous because your car could get permanently stuck for the night. In this scenario, conditions are too bad to make it to the gas station or anywhere but the side of the road. So you safely pull over to the shoulder of the road. Do you A, stay in the car, or B, set up flares? Flares as in, do you want people, so you can be seen, obviously, because it's whiteout condition.
Not like a pair of trousers or something.
That's another word. I see. That's why I always do this. Flares or trousers? Is that another word for pants? Flares?
Flares.
See, 70s I learned flares. You guys have all these fucking words. I think what the Brits did when they came to America is they dumbed English down a bit, because I don't know any of the Brit words. It's so funny.
Yeah, probably a good thing. I would stay in the up to a certain point, and I would stay in the car to see how conditions fare.
Yeah, that's it. Let's see here. Let's make sure. Stay in the car. No, set up flares so people can see you. It's whiteout conditions. We're both wrong. You want to be visible so that another car doesn't run into you. You're trying to basically broadcast, hey, I'm here, I'm on the side of the road, stranded. So you have those flares, or those light up, you call those torches, that you throw on the ground, and it makes a big red flame. And they burn really slow. Those things, not pants. All right. That's funny. Thanks for coming on the show, buddy. I do appreciate it. I hope to be seeing you soon, and I know we'll be talking soon. And like I always say, keep it simple, because crisis will complicate the rest, and be safe out there.
Thank you, buddy. It's been amazing to be part of the show. And I hope to see you soon.
Can You Survive This Podcast is a production of Calvary Audio and iHeartMedia. Recorded live from a secure location here in Dallas, Texas. Produced by Brandon Morgan, Jeff Apple, and Clint Emerson. Executive produced by Keegan Rosenberger and Dana Brunetti. For Calvary Audio, I'm Clint Emerson.